The following episode at the Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
It's almost time. 10 seconds. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Blast off.
The Spook Who Sat by the Door, the controversial best-selling novel, now becomes a shocking screen reality. The story of the first black agent in the CIA.
Raise your right hand and repeat after me.
For 5 years, he was their token Negro. He kept his cool and let himself be used. And in return, they taught him how to spy, how to fight, and how to kill. For 5 years, he was the spook who sat by the door. And then, he turned the American dream into a nightmare.
This is not about hate white folks. It's about loving freedom enough to die or kill for it if necessary.
The Spook Who Sat by the Door. Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
Hang on, brothers and sisters. Liberation is near.
Look out, Whitey. Black Power's gonna get your mama on this week's episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White, and with me, as always, is my main man, Mondo Justin.
Bow, bam, bow. Free your mind and your ass will follow, suckers.
This week, we're looking at the subversive black classic, The Spook Who Sat by the Door. Directed by Ivan Dixon, this 1973 film stars Lawrence Cook as Dan Friedman, the first black man in the CIA. Freeman learns all the dirty tricks of the agency before going back to the slums of Chicago to pass on his knowledge to a street gang, creating a guerrilla army ready to take Whitey down. So, Justin, what are your thoughts on the film this week?
You're probably going to hate me for this one, but after trying a few times to get through The Spook Who Sat to the Door, I'm not actually a big fan of the film.
No?
No, and it's not because I don't appreciate the film, okay? Because I do very much. I want to make that very clear to you. You know, I appreciate the performances and especially, you know, the direction. And of course, I really appreciate, you know, how the film fits into this historical context, you know, but there's just a lot that I don't like about the film as well. So I'll tell you first what I don't like about the film. And then after that, I'll tell you what I do like about the film, if that's okay.
Yeah, feel free.
Okay, so, you know, first off, I just found myself like not caring about any of the characters at all. You know, no one was particularly likable in any way. I know it's sort of the point, but the characters are just very one-dimensional and stereotypical to me, and that just doesn't work for me ultimately. You know, I thought the whole concept was just particularly silly. You know, just like from the start, you've got that scene with the senator, the congressman, and his two secretaries, and, you know, they're like, you know, these are the only three people in the world that secretly know that the CIA doesn't employ any African-Americans. You know, it's like right there, you know, this is going to be this fantasy.
The senator's solid with the Jews, Mrs. Hennington. The Negroes are the trouble spot.
The Negroes? I'm the best friend those people have in Washington.
The computers indicate a sharp decline immediately after your law and order speech last winter.
All right. Now let's see if we can come up with some ideas here. How do we retrieve the lost black vote?
Gil, why don't we accuse the CIA of a racially discriminatory hiring policy? They have no Negroes, except on a menial level, you know.
Certain, but I mean, that may be it.
And, you know, that scene where they're breaking into the car yard or something like that, you know, and they're dressed like cat burglars and all black, it's just very silly to me. So basically, you know, the lack of likability of the characters, I just had a real hard time with. And, you know, I found it really hard getting through it. I tried to watch it 4 times, and I did get through it, but it's just like halfway through, I'm just kind of like, man, this is running a little long. You know, like I found myself watching the clock. So I had, you know, real problems with the flow of the story. I just seemed to drag on, you know. So with that being said, what I do love about the film, firstly and foremost, is the score. You know, I mean, it's Herbie Hancock. I love Herbie Hancock. I mean, he cut his chops with Miles Davis. He is a hip-hop pioneer in the sense that he created the first sort of hip-hop record to win a Grammy with Rocket. You know, he did the score for Death Wish, and he's amazing. You know, and then after that, you know, one thing I do appreciate about the film, and this is not me going back on my previous statement or anything about the characters not working for me, but I really kind of related in a sense to like the the loneliness or isolation that Lawrence Cook sort of radiates throughout the film. I really appreciate that aspect of that character, even though I find him, you know, he's probably the character that has the most depth. So I really appreciated that, you know, it's just kind of like the only thing I picked up on from him, but that wasn't ultimately enough for me to fall in love with him and care about him. So that was kind of it, you know. Like I said earlier, I really appreciate the film for its historical context, the realism, the way the film fits into history. And we'll talk more about it later, so I don't want to stretch it out anymore, but I was really impressed with the direction of the film, you know, the way Ivan Dixon was able to produce what feels like a bigger movie than it actually is.
This one just blew me away the first time I saw it. I'm trying to remember if I saw the movie first or if I read the book first. I want to say I read the book first. Maybe that helped out, because then I could really kind of get into the mind of all these characters and stuff, because you're right, maybe coming at it as just a movie experience, the characters might be one-dimensional, and there wasn't that whole internal narrative that Freeman has throughout the entire book of it. Though there are moments in the film that are more fleshed out than some of the things that are in the book, like Pretty Willie's character is more fleshed out in the movie. He doesn't have that whole speech about passing for white and how he's not trying to pass and all that kind of stuff, and which I think is a great scene in the movie, and it's not necessarily in the book.
Look, man, I am tired of that. I am not passing. I am black. Do you hear me, man? Do you understand? I am black. I'm a nigga, you understand me? I was born black, I live black, and I'm gonna die probably because I'm black. Because some cracker that knows I'm black better than you, nigga, is probably gonna put a bullet in the back of my head.
There's a little bit more to him in the way that Freeman is trying to get into his mind a little bit more. And that's one of the things I like about the book a lot, too, is that it's such a psychological study of this guy and how he tries to manipulate people and try to get them on his side. And a lot of times it's really easy because of the situation that folks in the slums are in. And other times, you know, like him trying to work on his best friend, Dawes, I think is amazing, where he's just trying to get in there. And there is some of that in the movie. And that's one of my favorite scenes as well, is when they're sitting in that car and talking about how white people still perceive them, even though they're really moving up in the world and they've got these great careers and all this kind of stuff, just the way that they're still looked down upon by the white man, which I think is pretty great.
How long since you've been in bed?
Not since the riot started.
That was 3 nights ago, man.
Yeah, I know. Catnap when I can.
When did the National Guard come in?
Late last night. All white.
I noticed.
Yeah, the people didn't dig it when they woke up this morning and found the troops were here.
What do you think they'll do?
I can't see them trying to fight the army.
They didn't mind fighting the police?
Yeah. I never seen them like that.
Well, maybe that badge has put distance between you and them.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. The pigs over here and the people over there. And never the twain shall meet, huh? Hey, man, I grew up down here, too. And I know these people. Now, there were some good people out there in the streets the last few nights. Not just hoodlums, like they say in the newspapers.
In a scene like this, anybody can get involved.
But that's only gonna make it worse. We have to maintain law and order, or we might as well be back in the jungle.
Dawes, the ghetto is a jungle, always has been. Understand, you cannot cage people like animals and not expect them to fight back someday. It has always been an army occupation here, with police badges and uniforms. Huh? You and me, a cop and a social worker, we are keepers of this goddamn zoo.
The streets have to be safe.
Safe for who? You're here to protect property, not lives.
Well, that's what it's all about, isn't it? You worked hard to get what you got, didn't you? And you want to keep it just like I do?
Bullshit. Listen, you think because you got a badge and I got a couple of degrees, that makes a difference? Do you know what white folks call people like you and me in private? Niggers, dogs. Niggers.
I think you're right. You did read the book, and I haven't read the book. And I think maybe going in for me, I did watch the new documentary, Infiltrating Hollywood, first. Maybe that kind of ruined it for me because I almost feel like I was overhyped, you know, and then I got going and I was like, you know, I'm having a real hard time with this. And I stopped it, walked away, came back to it, you know, tried to sit through it later on, finally got through early morning one day drinking coffee. And so it's like, I just had a real, real hard time with it.
I'll tell you a little bit more about the book since I actually just reread it again because it's terrific. So the book was written by this guy, Sam Greenlee, for the listeners out there. And Greenlee, he wrote two books, two narratives, I should say. He's written a lot of poetry and stuff, even though at the end of his second book, his bio says that he's written four books altogether, and I don't know where the other two are. So you've got Spook Who Sat by the Door, which he wrote in 66, and then Baghdad Blues, which came out mid-70s, and to make things even more confusing, Baghdad Blues was set in an earlier time than Spook Who Sat by the Door. Baghdad Blues is very autobiographical because it's about this guy who joins the government and he goes over to Iraq and is really accepted by Iraq society, which is kind of strange. You know, it's very interesting in light of what's been going on, you know, in the last 20 years or whatever, like our relationship with Iraq. You know, I'm sure, Justin, you growing up, you weren't probably like, oh yeah, we got to solve these problems in Iraq. I never really thought about Iraq until like the Kuwaiti stuff happened back in the early 90s.
Reagan, 80s, the Iran-Contra, all that.
Yeah, exactly. And now it's like Iraq is in the news every single day and you can't get past it. And it's so funny now to read this book written in the mid-70s about a revolution that took place in the late 50s in Iraq. And just, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. But this one really, too, was looking at race and how this black guy was treated like a total second-class citizen in the U.S. He goes over to Iraq, and he's treated like one of them, or treated better, kind of leads, again, this double life. Amongst the Iraqis, he's accepted. Amongst his white coworkers, he's still really looked down upon. You can see where that planted the seeds in Greenlee's real life, where he took that real situation and kind of pushed it into this fictional realm.
Right from the get-go, for me, it always sounds like it's probably one hell of a book, and it's probably a better book than it is a movie. So I'm kind of sad I didn't get time to check it out. But
it is a really good book, and I do highly recommend it to folks. I don't know. I still like the movie, but yeah, again, I can see you coming to it and seeing, really, you saw the highlight reel by seeing the documentary that's been made about this film. So I can see where that would kind of taint you a little bit. Maybe if you had had more time in between them, you know, take a couple months off in between seeing Infiltrating Hollywood and then see Spook by the Door. Yeah, seeing them one right on top of each other, you're going to be like, oh, okay, yeah. All the mystery has been taken away from you.
Like I said, the score rocks.
The score is awesome.
The score is funky, baby.
And it's a shame because I don't think the score has ever been legitimately released. There's an album of it out there, and I found that to download, but it's one of these albums. There's like this British company who puts out basically bootlegs of blaxploitation films. They did one for Black Shampoo as well. And you can hear all the dialogue, and they put all the tracks in out of order, and it's like, what are you doing?
What's a bootleg?
I know in your sheltered world, you don't know anything about these bootlegs, but it does go on. So while I was doing a little research on this thing, I didn't realize, because there's a riot in the film that they shot in Gary. They shot almost the whole film in Gary because Chicago, where the book is set, was not about to have the crew in there. But I was amazed at just how many riots there were in the 60s. I mean, you and I are very familiar with the 67 riot in Detroit. And of course, you know, Watts, everybody talks about the Watts riots and people talk about the Rodney King riots and stuff. But I'm talking like 1964 to like 68, 69, you know, even into the 70s, there were just so many riots and stuff. So him writing this book in 66 is just like right on top of it, you know, right in the zeitgeist and stuff. And then they made the movie in 72, released it in 73. So it's like, it's got to be such a different experience for us watching this now and 2011 compared to folks who saw this thing in 73.
Oh, I'm sure. And I'm sure it lit a lot of fuses, you know, back in 1973 as well, because look what was going on. Like you said, you had the riots, but then you also had like the follow-up to the Watts riots. You had Watts Stack, you know, which was the big concert in the wake of the riots, which was revolutionary. You had the Black Panthers. I mean, it was a real important time.
And then, yeah, it's just so many great folks came together to make this. I mean, I don't know if you've ever had the chance to see Dixon's other stuff. I mean, mean, he directed like just a shitload of television stuff, but he also directed one called Trouble Man. Have you ever had a chance to see that?
Of course. And I own the Marvin Gaye soundtrack. You know, nice. One thing on vinyl, mind you, too. But, you know, one thing you have to, you know, mention about Dixon, too, is to use the word that he directed shitload of episodes is a little understating. You know, he directed an episode or two of every single television show that you could possibly think about, you know, that aired in the 70s, like Starsky and Hutch, The Mod Squad, Rockford Files, SWAT, Quantum Leap, even in the 80s, you know. And, you know, he did episodes of I Spy with Bill Cosby. You know, that is interesting because Dixon actually directed the early episodes of the late 60s Cosby television show as well. So there's clearly a tie-in with Bill Cosby and Ivan Dixon. You know, Dixon was definitely, you know, like, for example, someone like William Crane, who directed Blackula, you know, who also cut his teeth in television in the 70s. They were both definitely in the Aaron Spelling Rolodex of, you know, go-to television directors.
Right, yeah. And then I really was only familiar with Dixon as his role in Hogan's Heroes, played Kinch in that. And man, he was, I didn't realize that Hogan's Heroes ran for like over 5 years. It's like, it just seems like such a strange concept for a television show in the first place. And then that it ran pretty good long time and stuff. And it's just like,
it was very ahead of its time if you think about it, you know. And you know, got to think how more interesting it would have been had they played up certain elements a little more stronger instead of went for the extreme comedy, you know, Hogan, you know. But, you know, listen, on that note, Dixon as an actor too is really fascinating because you're forgetting, you know, he had this great part with Stella Stevens in Cassavetes' Too Late Blues, and he was also in Raisin in the Sun and Patch of Blue with Portier. And then he was in one of your favorites, Car Wash. You know, he had a real interesting career, and it's kind of sad. You know, they kind of touch on it in the documentary too about how, you know, I think it's his widow who says, you know, that he can never kind of escape his destiny in television, which is kind of sad.
But yeah, Trouble Man is just amazing. I love that film. And yeah, I forgot about the Marvin Gaye soundtrack, which is just terrific. That was one of those ones where wasn't out on DVD for a long time, and then when it finally came out, I don't know, I just missed seeing it on VHS, and I wasn't sure. You never know when you pick up a blaxploitation film what you're going to get, if you're going to get something absolutely sublime or just complete garbage. And there's very little gray area in between. But man, Trouble Man is just right up there with, I mean, the cast is amazing, Robert Hooks and everything. And then the dad from the Waltons as one of the most corrupt white cops I've ever seen, you know, not as crazy as those guys from Candy Tangerine Man or anything. So it's funny, like Dixon played with the building blocks of blaxploitation and then turns around and makes Spooky Sat by the Door, which just completely subverts everything.
Right.
Trouble is here. He wears $600 suits, drives a $10,000 car, and he carries two guns. One to stop trouble and one to make trouble.
Ooh, I come apart, but now who?
He was born in the ghetto.
I didn't make it, baby, playing by the rules.
Raised in the streets.
I come apart, baby, but now I'm fine.
Trouble is this man's name.
Checking trouble, sugar. Moving down the line.
Trouble Man.
Ain't gonna let it sweat me, baby.
If you're looking for trouble, look out, cause trouble is here. Robert Hooks is Trouble Man. You jive him, and he'll wash you away. Trouble Man, from 20th Century Fox, rated R, under 17, not admitted without parents. Trouble Man, with an original Marvin Gaye score.
I know that Spook has been released on VHS. I never saw it on VHS. It was one of those kind of tapes, kind of like A Brother, First Black Superman, where it just kind of got passed around a lot, and you would see it, you know, on different bootleggers' trading lists, as it were. And suddenly it just came out on DVD, and it's like, oh, okay, you know, now I finally get to see this movie. For some reason, I just passed by that one earlier. And when I saw Spook, I didn't know what I was getting into when I picked up the book, and the book blew me away. And then when I saw the movie, I thought for sure they're going to tone down all kinds of stuff and it'd be one of those like, oh, look at what a whitewash they did with this movie, pun intended. But they really didn't pull any punches with it.
Something I totally forgot to mention earlier when I was when you asked me what I thought about the film was, I don't have any proof, but I'm curious to know if that hallway in the film, in the few opening minutes of Spook, you know, where they're walking down the hallway, which maybe is supposed to be like the hallway in the Pentagon or something, it looks identical to the hallway used in the opening scene of the Don Knotts' Incredible Mr. Limpet, which is this, you know, scene that goes for like these two generals walking down a hallway identical to that for like 5 minutes. It's just massive hallway. Huh. When I first watched Spook, I'm like, are they in the Mr. Limpet hallway? it looks identical. You should check it out. It looks so close to the same thing. It's sick.
So you got like Dan Freeman going one way. You got the guys from Limpet going the other way. Then you got Maxwell Smart coming off another hallway, like looking for the phone booth.
Don Knotts is the animated fish crawling down the hallway. Yep, exactly.
So I know you said that you didn't necessarily care for the characters in the film. They were kind of one-dimensional, but did you relate to any of them, like any of them in particular, or just completely not at all?
Like I said, I did appreciate one particular element of Lawrence Cook as Dan, and that was just, you know, kind of like how he was this sort of outsider. You know, you could really feel that he was an outsider, you know, through the beginning of the film. I'm talking about, you know, particularly that scene at the front where, you know, he's working in his hotel room, the guys come in and ask him to go out for a drink, and he turns him down, then he almost gets in a fight.
Listen, we're going into Washington. You want to come along with us?
No, got some studying to do.
They've been letting us in town for a month now, man, and you ain't been out of here yet. More nuts in here.
Well, maybe next time.
Maybe you gotta cool it.
Cool it?
Mm-hmm. Cool it. If you weren't so eager to please the white man and send the grading curve up, there'd be three times as many of us here now. What kind of Tom are you, anyway?
Same as you, I guess. Except that I don't try to have it both ways. And you better watch what you say about white folks. Behind their back, this place could be bugged.
Are you calling me a tall man?
Well, none of us were picked for our militancy now, were we? Now, why don't you go away and let me alone?
Why don't you join the team, man?
Team? Man, I'm not playing any games.
Man, you just don't belong. I think you'd be happier with a mop in your hands.
Like your mama.
Let's step outside now.
No. No. You don't want to step outside with me. Because, baby, I would kick your ass.
You know, so I really appreciated that sort of obsession that he had, you know, temporary obsession. But in terms of favorite character, and he's probably the worst character in the movie for me, is the one I hate the most, is the mulatto guy.
Oh, Pretty Willie. That's the guy who I said I liked the most.
Oh, yeah, I hate that guy. Every time that guy's on the screen, I want to punch him.
What's your problem with Pretty Willie, man?
Just annoying. Just annoying.
He does have quite an interesting voice, but...
He's the Danny Manigan of Spook Who Sat by the Door for me. How's that?
I liked Pretty Willie a lot, and I liked Dawes a lot, his buddy who was on the police force and stuff. I think they could have introduced Dawes a little bit better. You know, it's interesting to me that this was adapted by Greenlee and this other guy, Melvin Clay, who... I think he had only done a couple films. There's one called Overload that I'm looking to find by him. And then I like the woman that they refer to as the Dahomey Queen, who's the prostitute that Freeman goes to.
Yes.
Which is a weird relationship where he's got the prostitute and then he's got Jill, I think her name is. And there's just, you know, no problems in there. Like the relationship between him and the two women, well, between him and Jill, is a little bit different in the book than it is on screen. But it still is very casual, just him like, oh, yeah, I'm going to go see this prostitute. Well, whatever.
Yeah, and it's very stereotypical as well, unfortunately. But, I mean, I can see how that is used to an effect, which is fine, you know. But it's like, geez, an African-American with a girl on the side? You know, it's like, how many, not to stereotype anything myself, but, you know, it's very common in black exploitation film. And I know this is not supposed to be a black exploitation movie, but, it, you know, it's very stereotypical, I think.
What I liked in the book is that he sets up different covers around the place. It's kind of that, you know, Ricky Nelson kind of thing. He's got a lot of girls in different ports, but he's got like this almost character that he plays when he leaves Washington and he goes up to New York and he, you know, has better suits up there. He goes to different clubs up there. He's got this woman up there. You know, he's got all these kind of things going on. And then, you know, at one point when he finally graduates from the CIA and becomes an agent, he just closes down that part of his life, ships some of the stuff over to Chicago, and then that's it. You know, it's like all these different covers that he has and just the way that he can play different roles to different people, which I find fascinating. And the thing, you know, you were talking about that scene earlier where they were in the hotel room. The thing that I like about the beginning of the film is him wearing glasses and just kind of doing that Clark Kent kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, it's great.
And he's just the silent observer, and just he goes under the radar the whole time. There's that one part where they're talking about the class of these black guys, and the white guys that are in charge are just so sure that all of them are going to fail out.
How long before this experiment in integration ends?
There are only six left in the group, General.
And?
The top-ranking man academically will fail the physical requirements. He's no athlete. Another figures to flunk this week's exam, but one might make it.
You assured me 2 weeks ago no one would survive.
Somehow I forgot Freeman even existed. He has a way of fading into the background. But he's been among the top three in academics and first in athletic training.
Yes, they do make good athletes.
With the documentary, I like the documentary because, you know, I'm a history buff, and so I did really appreciate these filmmakers setting out to create this documentary. But ultimately, for me as well, the documentary was just a shade too long for me. I could actually see someday this film getting a really, really epic DVD release or Blu-ray release, you know, where this documentary is actually featured on the disc with the movie. And then, yeah, so, you know, what's going on with the DVD in the sense that if you look it up on Amazon, there's literally about 20 different versions of the film on DVD. So is there one particular version that people should get?
Monarch Video is the one that is what folks should look for, released back in 2004, right at the beginning of the year. And that's the one that Tim Reed from WKRP and Frank's Place put out. His company put that out. So great transfer. I think it's got commentary on there. It's got some interviews, and it's got a nice little gallery of images from the film, and only $18 at the moment. So yeah, I'm hoping that they do have some sort of bigger DVD release of this along with the documentary. And I was very fortunate that I could speak to the two folks that are behind the documentary, Christine Ackham and Clifford Ward. And we talked a little bit about Infiltrating Hollywood. So let's go ahead and roll that interview. Please tell me about yourselves. What are your backgrounds?
I am a professor at UC Davis in the African American and African Studies department, but I teach all of the film, television, and media courses. My degree at USC was critical studies in the cinema school.
And then how about you, Cliff?
For me, I really didn't pick up on the spook until I met Christine. So that was maybe towards the beginning of the project. And I'm more of a production background. I've attended LACC, which is community college out here in LA.
So what kind of time frame are we looking at with this?
The journal piece was in 2004. The journal is called Screening Noir. Basically was sort of looking for information on it and called the publisher of the book to find out like how many copies had been published. And he's like, oh, why don't you just call the author? And I'm like, sure. And, you know, they gave me his number. And I basically called Sam and, you know, sort of opened up a relationship with him first on the phone. And then he came over to San Diego and I had a chance to meet him. But basically I was interviewing him at first for an article. This was right before the DVD came out. That's when I was sort of writing it, when I was interviewing Sam for it. And then that's when I basically started to think about making a film. You know, I was sort of by myself at that point in time. And so I was sort of like shooting on my own. And when he came out to L.A. for the premiere of the re-release of the film at the L.A. Film Festival, and I had a chance to meet with him and talk to him there and do an, you know, kind of do an initial shoot. And then I went to Chicago and started filming him there. But I really, you know, it was sort of like was working full time and was also by myself. And so I think we really got down to make the documentary in 2008, and I'd met Cliff probably 2005, and so, you know, I'd been talking to him about the project, and then we had an opportunity to sort of sit together, and, you know, he sort of got on board with it, and we started making it together.
What was your history with the film and with the book? When were you aware of these, and when did you see or read, and which came first? Did you read the book and see the movie, or how did that go?
Well, for me, it was I saw the movie first, and then I read the book. So 2007 was the first time I saw the film, and I was just blown away by it. So I went over to the book, and then that's kind of when we started to get everything all lined up for the making of the film.
And I saw the film back in 1995 when I first started graduate school, and then I read the book soon thereafter. And then, you know, sort of kind of kept my interest going from back then.
So what were your initial thoughts when you saw the film?
Oh, I was blown away by it because I kept thinking about the era and the time. And I'd seen it in the context of a class when we were watching sort of a lot of blaxploitation films and, you know, watching this film come out that came out during that period basically, but was so different and had such a sort of incredible message and, you know, didn't fall into some of the kind of tropes of blaxploitation film, but had, you know, enough of it to disguise it in that era. You know, it was sort of very fascinating to look at.
How did you go about tracking down all the folks that you managed to get into it? Just what was the nuts and bolts of making it?
Well, that was kind of the old-fashioned way. We opened the phone book, we contacted the DGA, we contacted anyone that was still alive that was on record by telephone. We did a lot of writing of letters because it's an older group, and we thought that they would respect a written letter more so than an email. So we just kind of hit the pavement.
Was it difficult? Did anybody turn you down? Were you looking for somebody that it took forever to find?
It took forever to find a lot of people. We did some like bizarre searches, like Janet League. I found her through the Huffington Post. I kind of did this random, totally profiling thing where I was like, okay, maybe she's a Democrat. So I did Huffington Post, and Huffington Post sort of publishes a who gave to whatever campaign. And then I found, you know, someone named Janet League and, you know, Janet League Katz. And I was like, oh, well, maybe that's it. So I like randomly sent a letter over to her, and she turned out to be the right Janet League. So, you know, and then she answered the letter and, you know, sent me an email. And, you know, so that's how we hooked up with her. Paul Butler was through Sam Greenlee. He had his phone number, so we were able to contact him pretty directly. So that one wasn't as much of a problem. Michael Kahn was, you know, pretty much what Cliff said. We were shocked to find out it was that Michael Kahn. And so tracing him down, you know, we did the DGA basically and sent, you know, a handwritten letter. I mean, not a handwritten, a type letter over to the DGA. And he just called us, which was, you know, incredible. And he was like, oh, I haven't talked about the Spooky Side by the Door in years. You know, he goes, actually said, I've never talked about the Spooky Side by the Door. Who did we have a hard time finding?
Well, we wanted to get Herbie Hancock, of course. We never really tracked him down or got in touch with his people.
Paula Kelly, that's someone we found her in sort of a weird way. Like, I traced her down. Like, at one point in time, I, like, talked to her hairdresser and, you know, got a contact there. And then that didn't pan out. And then I found out she was in a play in L.A. And I think she's the one who probably knew we were trying to do the doc, because I sent her a letter through the theater that she was doing the play at, and she never got back in touch with us. So I'd have to say that was the person we really tried to get, because, you know, I wanted to have, you know, there were two women in the film, and I wanted to try to get both of those voices in there, and then she did not respond to our letter.
I'm sure you already know, but Christine and I put this film together by ourselves. This is our first film that we've ever made. We edited this film in our new editing bay, which used to be our second bedroom.
And we funded it entirely on our own. Yeah. I think that was the big thing, is that, you know, we're sort of scooping out of debt after making the film. But I think that, you know, it was something that we really felt strongly about. And, you know, we sort of, you know, every time we had saved up enough money, we would head out on another interview to be able to, you know, pay for the flights and the hotels and everything. We just sort of, you know, scraped together what we could. And, you know, it was, you know, very much sort of that grassroots guerrilla filmmaking. Let's see what we can do on our own. And,
true,
you know,
indie filmmaking. True indie filmmaking.
You guys had a Kickstarter campaign. How did that go?
We were actually, you know, very, very nervous until the very end, but we were able to finish all the funding, and we're going to use that basically to try to get representation for the film. We actually have representation, but to get representation and also, you know, pay for that and pay for just sort of cleaning up some of the odds and ends in the film as well.
Yeah, I was curious if the version that I saw is the final cut or if there will be extra cuts after that.
We'll see what happens, but right now, some of that intro that we have may have to go in terms of distribution. We have educational distribution through Third World Newsreel. We're sort of working out the contract on that right now, but they were talking to us about that intro, the fact that some of those images that we thought were going to be able to be covered under sort of public domain things aren't going to be able to be covered. So we're going to have to, like, recut the intro of the film, but the rest of it.
And of course, if we bump into Herbie Hancock on the street or Robert Townsend or any contemporary person that is interested in speaking about the spook, we would most definitely make another cut, because it's all about getting the film back out there. Everything we're doing is about shining the spotlight back on the spook so people understand how important this film was to the community. And kind of the trials and tribulations of getting it made and put it together. And the film was funded by Black people from the community, doctors and dentists, and anyone that had money would contribute to the film. So we want to shine the spotlight back on the spook. So if anyone came forward today, we would 100% make a different cut of the film.
How was it interacting with Greenlee? Because he seems like he's a very interesting character.
I got to know Sam sort of slowly over the years. At first, he was, you know, it's all bravado all stories, you know, the most amazing stories that you hear from him. And he's very open, actually, you know. He has all of these incredible stories sort of filed in his head, you know, and he's ready just to, you know, give them to you and, you know, sort of just, like, pass them off. But I don't know, Cliff, what do you think? He's pretty open?
Sam is extremely open person. What you see is what you get with Sam. He and I kind of took to each other right away because we have a love of food. Even though he's like a very skinny man, he's a great foodie. So he and I kind of got along right off the gate, but he is such an amazing person who's had such amazing experiences, and he is so open to sharing it to anyone that wants to learn.
You always hear about him having, like, you know, these students over who are still writing and all of that, but I think that we were able to see some of the vulnerability of Sam because we knew him for such a long time and have gotten to know him, and that's something that he doesn't show all the time. So I think that that was sort of a really interesting thing for us to be able to get to that point where he was a little bit more vulnerable.
What's been the reaction to the documentary so far? I know that you screened it in Chicago, and where else has it screened, or has it?
Well, we have actually entered probably about 10 film festivals, and we've won Best Film in a lot of them. We've had nice turnout from Sacramento Film Festival. So pretty much everywhere we take the film, we get a pretty good reception. And a lot of the places, of course, Chicago, the Midwest, we have packed houses. So far the reception has been fairly good.
Did you have any problems getting the rights to put clips in the film? Is it Tim Reed still owns everything with that?
Yeah, no. Actually, Tim Reed doesn't own everything from it. His contract with the film fell back to Burley Dixon and Sam Greenlee. So they both own all the rights to the film, and they were really generous, and they signed off on us and the ability for us to use clips of the film sort of anywhere that we wanted, from the film to the internet to anything. They both were very, very gracious about it and just gave us the rights to use all of the clips.
Yeah, the story of getting the interview with Burley was a fantastic story. We actually sent her several handwritten letters. We had tried to get in contact with her through email, over the phone, and we really were hitting a brick wall. We had a last-ditch effort. We put together a new trailer for the film, and we sent it off to Burley. Burley took a look at that, and she immediately called us to come out to North Carolina. Christine and I were assuming that because she called us out that we were going to go ahead and set up and do the interview right out the gate, but she actually just wanted to see the rough cut of the film. But Christine and I did not know that when we got there to the place. She had her family there. She had her son and daughter there with her also. So we kind of were put on display for Burley and her family, and we were nervous because no one had really seen the rough cut of the film yet. So we were going, hey, it's not done. You know, we still got some things to do. We want to add some of this. But once we all sat down and watched the film, one of the most nerve-wracking times I've ever had, she loved it, and we set up after that to do the interview. So Christine and I were kind of sweating bullets here for one of our biggest interviews. Like, she wanted to see the rough cut of the film before she signed anything, before she did anything, and thank goodness she loved it because she pops off the screen, and she's like one of my favorite interviews. So
yeah, basically we were auditioning for her before we were able to do the interview.
What kind of stuff did you find out during the whole process that you found the most fascinating? Were there any, like, aha moments for you?
I guess one of the cool stories for me was realizing how the film was funded. You know, we always heard, oh, it was funded through the Black community. And, you know, Stan kind of gave us that idea about, you know, writing letters and, you know, trying to get people together. But I think Michael Kahn gave us a really interesting take, you know, the whole idea that they edited the film together as much as they could and that they would show it for various investors and that the investors would come in and decide whether or not they were going to give money towards the film based on, you know, the new cuts of the film. To me, that was just such an incredibly interesting way to get extra funding for the film. And that was just, to me, a really fascinating story. And it also led us to find the investors who had all those great documents that actually, you know, told the story of, like, the cancellation of the film through UA. So tracking down the investors through that was actually, that's a really interesting story. We found the investors we had interviewed the assistant editor of the film, and he says to us as we're finishing the interview, that's Thomas Pennick, he says to us at the end of the interview, oh, the funniest thing, I found an investor, I found out that, you know, one of the guys who was one of the big investors in the film is my dentist. Really? Your dentist? And I'm like, can I have cards? So he, like, gives us a number, and we're able to track down the investors through, you know, Thomas Pennick's dentist. So I'm telling you, it was a lot of weird, random things. But back to the question about things that we found out that were really interesting.
The thing that I found the most interesting is that everyone was so open and excited about talking about this project, because obviously we're sending letters and we're sending emails about a film that was repressed back in the 1970s. It's easy for people to kind of gloss over that and not really care or respond, but the responses were so warm and everyone was so inviting and so open with us through all the interviews throughout the entire country. That's probably the thing that hit me the hardest, is that we should have had a lot more trouble finding these people. We should have never been able to get to Michael Caine, you know? Like, everyone was so open and willing to talk about this project. That's the thing that kind of touched me the most about the entire thing.
Well, one of the things I found very fascinating was the voices of the folks that weren't involved with it, some of the scholars that you had, and some of Greenlee's contemporaries, Melvin Van Peebles. I've never known Van Peebles to say anything nice about anything that he wasn't directly involved in, so it was very nice to see him on screen actually giving someone some credit.
Yes, and he was a great interview, great guy. He invited us over to his home, and he actually had a unique home where he put together all of his furniture. His furniture was like, he had a filing cabinet that was a hot dog. He had a table that was a skylight that he had built. He had constructed all of this amazing art that was furniture in his house, and he was just so gracious by letting us come in and letting us leave our stuff there. He was just such a great interview and such a great time we had in New York. So he was really good. He was a really nice guy.
That's great to hear. That's awesome. How did you decide who you were going to reach out to for some more of those expert voices?
Well, we started with Eric Pearson down at UC San Diego because he's a colleague of mine from SCMS, the Society for Cinema and Media Studies, and I knew he was very interested in sort of that period of the Blaxploitation period, so he was sort of really very helpful in sort of giving us that foundational information. And then Ed Guerrero wrote an incredible book called Framing Blackness, where he really sort of outlines the Blaxploitation era, and so to me, he was, you know, just a shoo-in to give a call to in terms of that sort of background information. You know, he was perfect for that. And then as far as Todd Boyd is an old professor of mine who was my dissertation chair. And obviously that's the first place I saw the spook in his classes. And so he was, you know, once again, one of those sort of easy calls in terms of, you know, knowing someone who would just give you sort of the perfect amount of information for the background of the film.
Was there anything that ended up on the cutting room floor that you really wish you could have managed to fit into the film that just didn't have the proper place?
For me, there was a lot of background information on Sam that I think I started off the documentary wanting to have in there, but it really became sort of like a really heavy part of the film, and I couldn't figure out how to exactly integrate it well. So we got him actually to, in one of the interviews, he actually said his background really quickly, and so you got an idea of where he had been and sort of his life experiences. But there were some, you know, sort of interesting stories about his background that I think would make a great sort of piece on Sam alone. You know, if you were to do a sort of like a short piece on Sam and Sam's background, it would fit in really well. But in terms of the context of the whole documentary and getting all of the voices in for the whole doc, I think that was some of the stuff that, you know, we had to give up on.
So is that a possible DVD extra in the future?
Yeah, actually, that would be some great, you know, now that you mentioned it, some great extra material, because we definitely have all that stuff, you know, filed away, and, you know, all of these sort of really incredible stories about his time in Iraq and tales about things that he did in Iraq that were pretty incredible. So definitely that would make some great DVD extra stuff.
So are there any plans on bringing it to Detroit to show?
Yeah, now that you mentioned, that's really strange. I literally just got an email yesterday from someone who works at Wayne State University, and they just sort of invited me to come out there. So I'm still in the early points of sort of making contact with them and, you know, making some decisions about when they want to screen it and stuff. But yeah, it's going to be at Wayne State.
In your guys' opinion, is there anything else that is as subversive as Spook Who Sat by the Door?
You mean on the American side of things? Or because the Battle Dog, I think, would be, you know, the most sort of comparable film that was, you know, sort of underground and subversive. But in the States during that period of time, you know, definitely not. I haven't seen anything that matches up to what the Spook was able to do. And, you know, the idea of just how it did it, you know, sort of sneaking in under the guise of exploitation was just something that I think, you know, I haven't seen happen since. You know, kind of using the Hollywood machine to get what you wanted at the very end was something that was unbelievable. They were all sort of that spook sitting by the door, getting their film in, you know, getting that funding. You know, it's absolutely hysterical that they didn't bother to read the script, you know, just like, you know, who were the executives at UA? So they just definitely make that blaxploitation money.
That does sound interesting, his stories about Iraq, because I read Baghdad Blues, and just to see the parallels and stuff too between him there for this revolution, and then Spook is about a revolution.
Yeah, no, I think his stories about Iraq are really fascinating. You know, they're really, you know, stuff about, you know, when the actual, you know, revolution went down, how he was sent out in the field to, like, bring, you know, Americans back to the embassy, and, you know, how he was basically out in the street, and that he was considered, you know, because he was black, you know, he wasn't considered like all the other Americans. Back then, they were very accepting, and, you know, he sort of hung out, you know, because of sort of racism in the embassy, too, he found more camaraderie on the streets with other Iraqis, you know, and he learned the language, and I think that Baghdad Blues is semi-autobiographical as well. Obviously, like, he had met, you know, a lot of people that he got to know over there, and some of the characters matched the characters, I mean, the people that he met in Iraq, so that is all very fascinating stuff.
For folks that want more information about the film, where it's screening, what's happening with it, where should folks go?
Primarily, we put everything out through our Facebook page. So if you look up Infiltrating Hollywood on Facebook, that's where we put sort of everything up for screenings, et cetera. And I think people have been really good about sort of following what's going on the film there. Our next screening is at the Hollywood Black Film Festival on October 28th. I think it's 28th through 30th. We'll be out there at the Hollywood Black Film Festival. So that's our next screening for sure.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolikDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolikDB10. That's DiabolikPB10. Visit DiabolikDVD.com today.
Hello, I'm Dame Judi Dench, Her Royal Highness the Honorary Queen of the British Isles, parts of the Caribbean, and I have a scarf consortium in the basement of Harrods. I'm just here to tell you all about this wonderful, relatively new podcast from the After Movie Diner. There's movie discussion, interviews with independent film directors, music, and abject silliness. First thing every Monday, just in time for your sweaty and stressful commute. Or like me, maybe you're sprawled seductively on a chaise longue waiting for a really good breakfast. Tune in to the After Movie Diner by subscribing on iTunes or by going to amdpodcast.blogspot.com. And for one night only, the diner meets the drunk as we guest on the October 28th Halloween edition of the Drunk on VHS podcast, which is also on iTunes and Blogspot. You won't want to miss it. Some have called it disgusting, some have called it depraved, offensive, and not for human consumption. But I think it's jolly good. It's the episode they tried to ban, October 28th, the Drunk on VHS podcast. I'm sorry, but I must away. I have a proctology exam at 6. No rest for the wicked. Good nightingale!
Ahoy, mateys. This is K.A.B., Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340. KAB.
Okay, we're back. It was a real pleasure talking to Christine and Cliff about Infiltrating Hollywood. The documentary really is an invaluable addition to the film, but according to Justin, watch the film first and then watch the documentary. So, I mean, the movie itself is great, but the story behind the making of Spook Who Sat by the Door is... it's fascinating to me.
It's actually more interesting than the movie itself. Like I said earlier, I can really appreciate how the film falls in terms of historical context. And I think that's, it's a very important story. And it's, without us coming out right and saying it, you know, this was a censored film. Like we've talked about off mic, which is the film prints disappearing and the studio pulling it from, you know, from theaters and stuff like that. So with that being said, it is worth a watch because, you know, it's an important film, I think, but it's not one that you need to revisit multiple times. How's that?
Well, I find it fascinating because, I mean, there were so many movies, so many blaxploitation movies and other movies. You know, there were comedies around this time, just different films that were really like, let's go ahead and stick it to Whitey kind of thing. But this is the only one that I can think of where it's like, let's pick up arms and stick it to Whitey. You know, basically, it's calling for an armed revolution. And I can't really think of any other, you know, there's definitely no more blaxploitation films that do that. But other films where it's just like this call to arms, don't really get that too often, especially in American films. I mean, I can think of some films from other countries where you kind of got that. Propaganda obviously falls into that category. And some of it is akin to some of the things that you're seeing on almost like these Al-Qaeda networks where it's just like, let's go, let's, you know, kill these heathens, let's kill these infidels and stuff. And it's like, and they're making a good point in Spook Who Sat by the Door where it's like, wow, yeah, you guys really are put down at this moment. So maybe you should go ahead and have a revolution. And it's like, it's a little scary.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we talked a little bit off mic too about other revolutionary films where it's, you know, movies that are taking place during revolution where you kind of have that backdrop and stuff. And, you know, it always makes for a good historical backdrop when you've got, you know, like stuff like Reds and things like that, where you've got different revolutionary themes going on and who's aligning with who. And it's not necessarily a war film, but it's kind of related along those lines. And so I think the one that you mentioned that I totally forgot about was Switchblade Sisters. But Switchblade Sisters has that weird world to it. You know, it's not quite reality and it's not quite science fiction. You take stuff and you just push it a little bit out.
Switchblade Sisters is a classic. Both of them have a similar tone, I think, Switchblade Sisters and Spook, but obviously, you know, the revolutions are very different. And, you know, if I can think about it for a sec, you know, revolution has been a backdrop in so many films, and there's all different kinds of revolutions. You know, like you mentioned Reds, then you've got like Lawrence of Arabia, which is very much about revolution, and then like something like Braveheart, and then, you know, like Eisenstein's Strike, which is about workers, you know, rallying for their rights, and then like FTA, which is, you know, Jane Fonda, you know, with the women's movement, and Drums of the Mohawk with talking about the American Indians, and then even Star Wars is very much a revolution film, you know?
What I find hilarious is you had also mentioned V for Vendetta. That's been kind of a call to arms for like this whole Anonymous group and stuff, and I'm sure like you're going to see people wearing Guy Fawkes masks down at you know, Wall Street right now, and this kind of current revolution. It's a strange revolution, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to work or anything, but that one, I guess, is a little bit of a call to arms to folks to give a little back to Big Brother.
Yeah. You know, there's Soderbergh's Jay. I don't know if you've seen it, but sort of not one of Pacino's best films, but Revolution he did, where it takes place during the American Revolution. I think we could probably talk for hours about films that have revolution in them and in the backdrop.
But then there's other stuff like Hour of the Furnaces. Hey, you know, here's Jay, and here's all this stuff, and they've got the scenes like in the slaughterhouses and stuff. Go ahead. If you want to keep on, you know, submitting to the man, you might as well just step into this abattoir and enjoy yourselves. You know, hey, go for it. I was very fortunate that fortunate and unfortunate, because it's kind of an arduous film to sit through, and I got to see it for a film class, and like the last shot of it, as far as what I remember, you know, this is, you know, almost 20 years ago, the last shot of it is like Che Guevara on the slab after he'd been killed, and it's just like a still frame of his face for, it felt like 20 minutes. I'm sure it was only two or whatever, but it was just like, okay, the show of the martyr. It was breathtaking and just really got to me.
You say that now, but I hear you complain about Andy Warhol's Empire.
Che had a little bit more going on than Empire. I don't know. I saw an animated GIF recently of Empire where it's just like four or five frames and it just plays forever. This sums it up.
Animated GIF.
Yeah, and then Robert Kramer's Ice is coming out on DVD, or probably by the time this podcast plays, it will be out on DVD. I was watching that today, and that one was a little bit tough to watch because I don't remember when it was made, but it was like late 60s, early 70s, and you know, it's like all these white people, basically, and that's what the whole movie, I was just like, you people are suffering from white people problems, and it just didn't really ring true to me, especially coming off the heels of seeing Spook again, and it's like, okay, yeah, these guys really have problems, and you white people, you're just like petty arguments and this kind of shit. It's like, yeah, I don't know. Going back to Infiltrating Hollywood, I do love the whole story of the censorship and how all the prints were disappearing. You know, the film was like number one in Chicago when it opened. And then, yeah, FBI starts coming in and prints start disappearing. And next thing you know, there's no more movie anymore, which is really strange to think about. I mean, I wish that they would have done that to like Transformers 3, but
both films made in Chicago, both films that eventually were number one.
Oh, wow. Never thought about that before.
Black people, robots.
Yeah. And you had those two black robots, but unfortunately they were just in the second of the trilogy.
So how does Spooks Who Sat By The Door hold up all these years later?
For me... I think it holds up great, but for you?
For me, check it out once so you can say you've been there.
Let's go ahead and we'll just ruin things for people and we'll talk about the ending of the film. I find the ending very chilling, the lack of resolution.
Absolutely. That's a testament to the writing and that's a testament to the direction as well. And I mean, it's not a, can you say it's a story with hope? No. The ending is realistic to the state of the times the film was made, essentially. I mean, sure, things get better, but to what degree? Instead of racism being, you know, a sign up on the wall saying colored water fountain, it's brushed under the rug.
Yeah, instead of having minstrel shows and these kind of things, you get black robots and Transformers too. It's still there. You might have to look for it a little harder unless you're really tuned into it or whatever. But that's the thing I liked about the documentary too, is hearing Greenlee today talking about this stuff. He's still a firebrand. You know, there was no slowing this guy down. I mean, I was thinking about asking Christine and Clifford for Sam's contact info, and I was a little afraid. I thought for sure he'd be like, no way, white boy. I am not talking to you.
Yeah, I understand.
Very, very intense dude and very learned, though. And just, yeah, he was fascinating to listen to. And I could almost see them doing what they had originally planned and making a whole documentary just about him. So I wish that he had more material out there. I mean, I'm not really into poetry or anything. I'm much more into prose. So I'm probably not going to pick up all the rest of his books. But what I've read so far, I found very interesting. All right, surprisingly, The Spook Who Sat By The Door, both the book and the movie, as we mentioned before, are available via retailers around the country. One of the few times that I'm talking about a movie that's available still. It seems to be unavailable on Netflix, but here's hoping that, as Justin had mentioned earlier, here's hoping that the movie will be re-released and Infiltrating Hollywood will be part of the mix as well. Good luck to those guys, and I hope that folks check out their Facebook page, support them, and look for screenings around the country because it really should be seen. So we're going to take a break and we'll be back in a few minutes.
What's it like to be naked in front of 100 people?
Depends on the air conditioning.
To Kill 2.
Okay, we're back. That was the audio trailer for my pick next week, Strip to Kill 2, Live Girls. Be sure to tune in and hear what we have to say about the Maria Ford, Roger Corman-produced strip club Psycho Noir. So, Mike, what is it like to be naked in front of 100 people?
It feels good, but sometimes I get chafed from all the singles being stuffed into my G-string. Justin, will folks who are interested in Strip to Kill 2 have to see Strip to Kill 1? Will there be unanswered questions from 1 that can only be answered in 2?
Definitely not. Two different, completely different stories.
Good to know. So I shouldn't be tracking down Strip to Kill 3, which is a prequel to both stories then?
No, definitely not.
Okay, cool. All right, well, that's all the time we've got for this week. Thanks for listening, and thanks, too, for all the feedback folks have been leaving on our website and on our voicemail line.
Yeah, thank you very much. We'll never need to restock on Cialis ever again. And if you want to leave us some feedback, visit our website, www.projection-booth.com, or stop by our Facebook group, facebook.com/theprojectionbooth.
All right, we're going to leave you this week with another song from the Spook Who Sat by the Door soundtrack album by Herbie Hancock. Here's a track called It Begins.
Where's this wall, honey?
Don't quit until you either win or you die.